There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
You're on Team Human, rest stop on the information superhighway. A moment to press pause and ask, what are we doing for whom and why? Winter may be coming, but we are an adaptable species. Our ability to withstand what lies ahead will depend on our resilience, our solidarity, and the extent to which we can keep our evolved social mechanisms functioning in a world that has been designed to atomize, isolate, and divide us. Playing for Team Human today, Post-Carbon Institute fellow Richard Heinberg.
So if we're looking to new technologies to solve our existing environmental and social problems, many of which actually are the result of side effects of previous technologies, then I think we're just caught in a circle where we're chasing our own tail.
Richard, the author of Our Renewable Future, will be helping us figure out why so many of our immense strides for human progress have ultimately set us so far behind. It's time to intervene on behalf of humans. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and you're on Team Human. I normally don't become prey to distractions, particularly when those distractions are formulated just to distract us from something more important. But I did become interested in this whole distraction by our administration into the football players who are kneeling at the national anthem. And in case you haven't been keeping up, there's a football player, Kaepernick, who took a knee during the Star Spangled Banner before a football game last year as a way of calling attention to Black Lives Matter and some of the inequality that's plaguing his community in particular. And I don't think it was meant necessarily as disrespect. I mean, he was there for the Star Spangled Banner, but he wanted to leverage the moment to make people more aware of his concerns. And he pretty much threw away his NFL career in the process. He ended up, you know, an undrafted free agent because nobody wanted to take on this controversy, which is what it turned into. And later this year, a few other players started taking a knee during the Star Spangled Banner. And Donald Trump got, I was going to say Donald Trump got really mad about it, but more easy to say Donald Trump played really mad about it and decided to reframe these young men's efforts as being against the American flag or against America's troops, that this was unpatriotic and a way of really stamping, a new way of burning the flag. And it's real interesting because that was a one of Richard Nixon's techniques when he started to do really badly in public opinion. He brought up the flag burning issue. The whole flag burning thing in the U.S. was a Nixon distraction from Watergate and the war and everything else that was destroying his career. And the funny thing is, it actually works. You know, 90% of Republicans agree with Trump that this is a terrible thing and that they shouldn't be taking a knee, that it's unpatriotic. He went on to say that any football team whose player goes and takes a knee, they should fire that player. And I get that. Okay, there's that issue, and he decides to use it and distract us with that. But then he goes further. And this is where you can see Trump's sort of savant or genius begin to emerge. His object is fine, take a side, create division, and push it as far as we can go. So he starts talking about the concussions that football players get, saying, well, they're on their knee, and their sport sucks now anyway, because of all these mamby-pamby rules they're making to try to prevent these coddled, black, overpaid young men from getting injuries. So he's saying that, oh, the sport's less macho, less real, less compelling now that we're trying to prevent the players from getting brain damage. And then he says that, look, you know, hockey, those guys, they're still standing up. The hockey guys, they have a rough sport and they get all bloody and they're still standing up. You know, not these kind of coddled minorities. And we all know hockey is a largely, white a sport. I mean, and Russian for that matter. But the idea that, okay, I mean, think about it. Think about the election. Think about the objections to leftism, the objections to affirmative action. What a better, more simple and strident way to frame that than, look at this sport, which used to be we'd send a bunch of black guys out there to go clobber on each other. Now we're going to protect them. Now we're going to overpay them. And look what happens. They get uppity. Now they take a knee and they don't do the Star Spangled Banner. And for a lot of Americans, even ones who aren't racists, he triggers things. He triggers a little subconscious leftover racist resentment that's still there. You know, even if it's not in their public expressions, it's still in their subconscious. It's still latent. It's still certainly institutional. Or when he talks about the hurricane in Puerto Rico, the use of the third person to describe the people and the victims. It's them over there, those Puerto Ricans, they're resilient people. They got a lot of energy, as if he's, painting the picture of the Puerto Ricans, dancing to fast, Latin music or something. They'll be all right. They're over there. And when it's not working out, he argues, well, they can't help themselves. They're not doing their, we've sent all the supplies there. They don't know how to get it off the boat. So why divide like that? Why make all of these divisions? I mean, really? First, because it maintains the frenzy. We hear these sort of racist, dog whistles, as we call it, or this divisive language, and it gets us all freaked out. Second is it raises the bar for what constitutes uncivil or racist behavior. If you hear this enough, if he talks like this enough and these kinds of conversations begin happening, it creates a new normal for what is acceptable. What's an acceptable way to talk to women, about people of color? It raises the bar in a bad way, meaning it lowers the bar, but it raises the level of what can be expressed. And, finally, it speaks to the base, which is actually just a euphemism for galvanizing a racist movement, for galvanizing this rage, this divisive rage. He's saying what people are feeling on one level, but it's really, more importantly, a deliberate strategy to divide, to get hardcore supporters. And really to get hardcore supporters to support hardcore Senate candidates who will ultimately protect Donald Trump from impeachment proceedings. That's the strategy. You know, if you're so confused as to why someone would do this, that's the strategy. It's in the short term, it's to distract us from Russia, distract us from the economy or healthcare or whatever else is going wrong. And the long term is his personal survival, that in order to stick it out, he's going to need some senators who are the most radical, staunch defenders of his kind of rhetoric and his kind of behavior. And in order to get those, he has to galvanize his base. It is about that 30%. It is that 30%. That's all he needs, is 34% of the Senate to protect him, and then he gets to stay in office. It's not pretty, but it's where we're at, and it's what we're listening to. And the only real solution to this is for those of us in the media to call it what it is and not to accelerate it, not to provoke more of these hair trigger reactions from ourselves and our audience, but to promote the opposite reaction, to see, oh, look at this manipulation. Look at this attempt to trigger my panic button, to galvanize this base. Wow. Huh. And be calm about it. Be cool about it. Be connected about it. And then go on with the actual business at hand. You're on Team Human, our last best hope for peeps. Our guest today is Richard Heinberg from the Post Carbon Institute.
Hello, Team Human listeners. This is Steven here. Just a brief interruption to say thank you to all our Patreon supporters. Last week, we met our first Patreon goal. Your financial support is directly responsible for keeping us going week to week. Thank you so much for helping to make this show possible now and sustainable in the future. Your support is also helping make Team Human a project that involves an even larger team. Patreon subscribers are participating on the Team Human Slack channel. In fact, this week's guest, Richard Heinberg, comes thanks to the suggestion of Slack team members. We have a growing list of guest suggestions who we will feature in future episodes. So again, thank you for making this sustainable. Please share Team Human with your friends. Review us on iTunes. There's a link in the show notes. And back to Douglas and our special guest, Richard Heinberg, this week.
One of the problems I'm butting up against right now that I want, that I think you may have already solved, is the answer to our technological, environmental, economic problem. Is it to push through somehow, or to go back somehow, or is that even the wrong way of looking at it? In other words, is it smarter to retrieve as many aboriginal technologies and crop rotation and biodynamics and Lord knows what interconnected collaborative evolutionary models we can find, or do we just hire Monsanto to grow alfalfa on the ocean and call it a day?
Right. Well, I would put my money on more traditional technologies, frankly. And I have a lot of reasons for that. But just to get started, you know, every new technology has side effects. And often it takes us decades to figure out what those are and begin to deal with them. So if we're looking to new technologies to solve our existing environmental and social problems, many of which actually are the result of side effects of previous technologies, then I think we're just caught in a circle where we're chasing our own tails. And ultimately, I think the only way out of that is to deal with some, you know, really fundamental ethical and moral questions that we've been using technology to hide from. questions about population growth, questions about inequality and redistribution, questions about the scale of our economic activities in relation to Earth's resources and carrying capacity.
So, I mean, the question then, I guess, partly becomes, you know, how far back do we go? You know, so usually in my work, and I see in a lot of yours, you know, we kind of start at the beginning of the industrial age, where we started to use machinery and corporations to really externalize the social, environmental, and economic impact of the things we were doing.
Right.
So we could put Indian people on the mechanical looms and just bring back the beautiful rugs to England. Magic, you know, but is that sort of the starting place for this real, almost intentional ignorance about the effects of the things that we were doing?
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess in an ultimate sense, you'd have to say that the only really sustainable way that human beings can exist on the planet is as hunter-gatherers, and maybe even without fire. But nobody, we can't go there. I mean, not 7.5 billion of us can't go there. It's impractical. It's impossible at this point.
Right. So you'd say what? The invention of agriculture in the Axial Age kind of sent us off on the wrong path. I mean, the Bible would agree with you.
Yeah.
You know, Cain sacrificed grain and got got punished by God. You know, the one who was the shepherd, you know, little Abel, sacrificed a sheep and he was fine.
Yeah, and there are plenty of archaeologists and anthropologists who agree with that. You know, that when we transition to eating mass-grown grains, our skeletons became smaller and shorter, and all sorts of diseases appeared. Once we started, you know, living with domesticated animals, we got we started sharing all kinds of diseases back and forth, and it's all been in a sense, it's all sort of been downhill ever since. Even though, from the standpoint of human wealth and control over our environment, it seems like nothing but progress ever since. So, you know, those are two very different ways of looking at the situation. And I think you could put your finger at any point along that trajectory and say, well, you know, we should have stopped there. Or if we could have stopped there, we could have a much more sustainable situation and maybe even a happier one for a lot of people. But it's clear that where we are right now, we're going off the charts, just off the spectrum of what we'll be able to sustain for much longer.
Well, right. Partly because, I mean, it's partly digital technology, but really, you know, moving from the, I guess it was really the oil, you know, the fossil fuel burning technologies that let us really start digging stuff up a whole lot faster than a farmer with a ox and a hoe.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you look at the technological transitions, fire was a really important one, and then agriculture, and then you go to fossil fuels. And in some ways, that's the most fateful of all, because they've enabled us to increase our population, our extraction of resources, our ability to transform resources and transport them and transport ourselves to a far greater degree than anything else in previous human history.
So, I mean, the way I used to look at you know, Judaism and Talmud and all was that it was trying to prepare us for this. In other words, that the ancients understood that, oh my, if we're going to transition from this kind of Bedouin, almost a hunter-gatherer-like existence. I mean, they had their own sheep, but
right.
You know, they were wandering around the desert, and when we're going to move from that to a planted, agriculture-based civilization, we're going to have all sorts of new concepts coming into place, like property and debt and storehouses and ownership. And, oh my gosh, we're going to need to develop an ethical tradition in order to handle a civilization like that.
Right.
But we didn't really get one, though, for some reason.
Yeah, and I think as technology has sped up, as economic growth has sped up, our ethics have fallen ever further behind. you know, the ethics that we would need to enable us to adapt to a world of high technology and fossil fuels. You know, maybe that would take 500 or 1,000 years to develop, but we haven't had 500 or 1,000 years. We've had a couple of hundred years, and we still have basically the same drives operating within us and within society as a whole as we did, you know, back in the 17th century. So we're still treating the world as if it were an unlimited storehouse of goodies, even though the environmental limits to climate, to resources of all kinds, are staring us in the face. You know, ultimately, I think we would develop an ethic based on, well, for lack of a better word, sustainability. You know, the notion that we cannot increase the rate at which we use non-renewable resources, that to do so is evil. You know, I mean, that's what ethics are all about. It's identifying what we shouldn't do, and we shouldn't extract and use renewable resources faster than they can replenish. Those are two, you know, commandments that didn't get written on the stone tablets, you know, 3,000 years ago. But today we really need them, and without them, we're banging our heads against extinction.
Well, indeed. I mean, the issue is, when I bring this up, in particular with my kind of West Coast Silicon Valley friends, they'll say, oh, Doug, it's because you can't envision what our technologies are going to be able to do. Ooh. So yeah, you know, if you were a caveman, you can't deplete your aquifer faster than, you know, the centuries or millennia it takes for water to flow through rocks and get there. But now we can just desalinate the ocean, or we'll put solar windows, and God bless Elon Musk, that all our roofs are going to supply more electricity, and we won't need to dig anything out of the ground ever again.
Right. And, you know, there are certainly technologies on the horizon that will help us adapt to nature's limits. I mean, it's I'm all in favor of replacing fossil fuels with renewable energy sources like solar and wind. And there are other things that will help at the margins. But I spent a year looking specifically at renewable energy and the prospects for renewable energy, and looking at the rates of investment and technological change. And I came away from that, well, with a book to show for it. It's called Our Renewable Future. But also with the conclusion that the transition isn't going nearly fast enough. It'll have to go about 10 times faster. And there are all sorts of adaptations we're going to have to make to using intermittent energy sources, energy storage, capacity redundancy, demand adaptation, that are going to require not only tons more investment, but also changes in the ways we use energy, in our habits and expectations. And that part of the equation never really gets talked about. You know, it's all usually about, well, it's just a political problem. All we have to do is get the fossil fuel industries out of the halls of government, and the transition to solar and wind will be driven by market forces, and we'll all be fine. But it's not nearly that simple. We're talking about a transition to energy sources that have fundamentally different characteristics that are going to require a shift in basically our whole economy, and whether we can even have a growth-based economy with renewable energy sources is, I think, an open question. So again, we're avoiding the need to confront basic changes in our behavior and expectations. We're avoiding that by appealing to technologies that in some ways maybe don't exist, or in other ways, you know, don't exist at scale.
So we're not just talking about the shift from a Chevy Malibu to a Tesla here.
Right.
I mean, and that's partly because, correct me if I'm wrong, but a Tesla, don't you have to send kids into a cave in Africa to get some rare earth metals to build these batteries? And isn't there a limited amount of that stuff?
Right. Yeah, I think there's enough lithium for us to build one generation of electric cars with batteries. But once those get old and have to be replaced, then we start running into trouble. Conventional economic theory says whenever any resource starts to get scarce, the price goes up, and then that results in substitution. We find something else that will do the job just as well. Well, the problem is the periodic table of the elements is not infinite. And so, you know, at some point, we start running out of things to substitute to. And when I say some point, I'm not talking about 1,000 years from now. You know, we're running through the periodic table in short order. And, you know, some things are, you know, really, really abundant. I don't think we're going to run out of sand or limestone. But in terms of materials that have unusual properties that enable us to build Teslas and even wind turbines and solar panels, some of these elements are becoming scarce already.
Right. So then the answer is not to find necessarily new ways to fulfill our current energy requirements, but to somehow back up on our energy requirements.
Yeah. And that's what nobody wants to hear, because energy is the basis of the whole economy. Without energy, nothing happens. And if you want economic growth, realistically, you're going to have increased availability of energy. There's some wiggle room. Economists talk about decoupling, you know, decoupling energy growth from economic growth. And there's some evidence that a little of that has occurred in the past. We might be able to get a little bit more by changing to solar and wind away from coal and natural gas. You know, when you burn coal and natural gas to produce electricity, you waste a lot of energy in the process. So if we make the renewable energy transition, then we'll avoid a lot of that waste, and that'll give us some more efficiency. But there have also been some recent studies that have called the whole question of economic decoupling into doubt, showing that most of the decoupling that economists point to in the past has really just been false accounting. In the end, you know, if we don't have more energy, it's not going to be possible to grow the economy forever. But
well, that gets you to the question, though, of why do you have to grow the economy forever? I mean, that's what my last book was looking at, was we've accepted that as if it's a premise of nature, when it's really just the rule of a 13th century economic operating system that was invented to slow the rise of the merchant middle class. You know, and if that's all it is, if it's not a foundational principle of human transaction, but one hack by one small group of wealthy people to solve a very particular problem, then we should be able to abandon it a heck of a lot easier than it seems.
One would certainly hope so. I mean, as it is, you know, politicians of every stripe, just about all economists, tell us we need economic growth constantly in order to stave off financial and economic collapse. You know, we need economic growth in order to provide jobs, returns on investment, increased tax revenues for government services, all this stuff. But, you know, the economy cannot grow forever on a finite planet. That's a simple reality. And the sooner we understand that, the sooner we'll be able to design an economy that actually does work within the bounds of this, you know, small blue-green marble floating in space.
Right. I mean, again, you know, I keep getting reminded of the Bible when I'm talking to you. I guess because we're really talking about, you know, instilling Western civilization with an ethical tradition. But again, that's what, you know, what Joseph went and taught the Pharaoh, you know, oh, when you have 7 good years, store up all this stuff, because then there's not going to be any left for 7 years, and then you can put everybody into debt. You know, so we invented this debt-based economy, which is the evil. I mean, that's what enslaved everybody. And we're in that now. We're in 400 years of an enslaving debt-based economy that we've come to regard as the conditions of nature. And so decoupling that, in a sense, or disconnecting that from our reality seems, it seems a requirement if we're going to move back within the carrying capacity of our planet.
And we've gotten so addicted to growth that you know, as growth slows down, and it is slowing down, I mean, economists even have a name for it now. They call it secular stagnation. The global economy has been stagnating for the last decade or so, and we've made up for it by hitting the accelerator on debt. You know, central banks with quantitative easing, right, and super low interest rates and so on. So the idea is, you know, consume now and pay later. We pump up consumption now in order to grow the economy, but we do it by creating these obligations for the future that are never going to be repayable.
Right, that require even more growth.
Exactly. It's a Ponzi scheme. I mean, let's call it what it is. And these things never end well. And there are plenty of historic precedents for societies that have, you know, tried to evade limits by pumping up the debt machine. And it always ends the same way.
Which are some examples, ready examples of that?
Oh, well, there's a whole book called Secular Cycles, where an economist and an ecologist looked at about a dozen examples in over the last 1,000 years. And, you know, it's they found the pattern, and it was very clear, and it repeated itself again and again. And typically it's about 300 years from the beginning of an economic cycle till it busts. And we're at the tail end of such a cycle right now. I mean, about 300 years ago is when the fossil fuel revolution just began, and now all the characteristics of our present age align perfectly with the characteristics that Turchin and forget the other author's name identified.
I mean, in some ways, what you're saying reminds me of John Stuart Mill, the English philosopher, who really, he was the first one I saw who used that phrase that you use a lot, which is carrying capacity. Mm-hmm. And the problem when I start to make arguments like yours about the carrying capacity of the planet and living within our limits, is that it's not only considered somehow un-American and anti-capitalist and anti-Christian and anti-everything, but I get accused of being a sort of Club of Rome Malthusian pessimist, mm-hmm. as if Malthus was somehow scientifically disproved. You know, was he?
Well, over the short run, yes. I mean, here's the thing with carrying capacity. It's possible to stretch carrying capacity temporarily. And we've done that. You know, we've increased global food production dramatically over the past few decades with the Green Revolution. But when you do that, what you typically do is you erode long-term carrying capacity. And we've certainly done that. We know we're losing about 25 billion tons of topsoil every year as a result of our modern agricultural practices. And similarly, we're drawing down ancient aquifers. The bees are going extinct, on and on and on. You know, the prospects for humanity's future food supply are pretty dire as a result of the things we've done to increase the food production over the short term. So over the short run, you know, the last couple of hundred years, Malthus is disproven, you know, but over the long run, I'm not so sure. And as far as the Club of Rome goes, you know, the 1972 Limits to Growth study was, as far as I've been able to tell, one of the most important pieces of intellectual work in human history. And all of the noise that a lot of conventional economists made pretending to debunk it was just that. It was just noise. They took a few figures out of context and tried to debunk something that, in fact, is showing us exactly where we are and where we're going.
Right. The same way that, you know, climate change got debunked because they took a line or two out of an email that called some anti-climate change scientist an asshole, right. You know, and then all of a sudden it's one big conspiracy.
Yep, exactly.
I mean, and then there's the folks, you know, like Steven Pinker say, who say, look, things are getting better. The world's gotten less violent every century.
Yes.
You know, you can get a tuna fish sandwich now, that the average poor person lives better than a monarch did 200 years ago. So shut up and stop complaining.
Yes. Yeah, you know, there's a saying, the future's already here. It's just not evenly distributed yet.
Mm.
And I think we are seeing the disorder that's being generated by our current ways of living in parts of the world where you and I don't live, you know, places where people who are happy with the current state of affairs, you know, would prefer not to think about. So you look at places like Venezuela and Puerto Rico and Syria, and you know, basically things are just falling apart, or they've been run over by climate change or war. And yeah, we've always had war, we've always had natural disaster, but the kinds of natural disasters and wars that are being set up now as a result of the way we're running the world are more serious and widespread than anything we've seen in the past. I you know, I don't want to be apocalyptic here, but you know, if we keep going the way we're going now, climate change, resource depletion, overpopulation, and the rest are setting us up for decades down the line in this century, when what we're seeing in Venezuela, Puerto Rico, and Syria now will be the norm across the world. The very same sets of circumstances that led to what's going on in those countries is emerging across the board. And unless we change what we're doing, that's where we're headed.
Well, one of your main approaches to initiating that change is to build, you know, what you're calling the community resilience movement, you know, as part of the Post-Carbon Institute. Now, to enable community resilience, are we talking about changing human nature or sort of retrieving some aspect of human nature that we left behind?
Yeah, I think it's unwise to count on changing human nature, because it's taken hundreds of thousands, if not millions of years to evolve to what it is. But it's definitely true that our current system pushes human nature in certain directions, you know, with advertising, with market-driven economies. We push our human nature in the direction of competition, of addictive behaviors, and that's not the sum total of who we are. You know, we human beings also have lived in societies that were held in check by ethical systems that talked about the evils of greed and gluttony, and talked about the virtues of sufficiency and generosity. We've forgotten those virtues and vices to a very large extent because they don't fit with the necessities of the market economy. But they're just as much rooted in human nature as, you know, staring at screens all day and ordering stuff on Amazon. So I think what we have to do deliberately is begin to revive those aspects of human nature, those aspects of ourselves that we've let slip away.
And what do you see as the sort of the mechanisms for that? I mean, when I hear you talk, I think, you know, yeah, my nonfiction and fact-based work has been fine. And, you know, this show is nice because it's sort of rallies people together. But it kind of makes me want to do, you know, theater or nursery school curriculums.
Yeah.
Or do you know what I mean? I almost want to get to some more fundamental place in human consciousness.
Right. You know, when we talk about this stuff person to person, people all go, well, yeah, of course, that's just common sense. Sharing more, having more of a sense of community, you know, being more generous and less greedy, all that stuff is just makes sense. And in a small group of people, it's natural to us, and those instincts still come to the fore. That's why we talk about community resilience rather than, you know, trying to overcome the market economy and, you know, or defeat capitalism or something like that. Those are long-term idealistic projects that people have been talking about for decades. What makes more sense is paying attention at the level where those values still predominate at the community level, and doing what we can at the community level to build the resilience that we're going to need over the next few decades in order to survive the consequences of how we're living right now. Resilience is the ability to bounce back and maintain basic functions and identity. And that's what we're going to need in the age of climate change and all the rest. And the best place to build that resilience is at the community level, where we can talk with one another in ways that get around the kinds of cultural messages that are dividing us right now. I mean, you look at the political landscape in America, and everybody agrees we're getting too polarized. Well, you know, what's the solution for that? I'm sure there are candidates we can vote for and so on. But I think the most important solution for that is just for us to get out and talk to one another more locally and see each other as fellow community members rather than as, you know, red or blue or, you know, members of categories.
Right. It's harder and harder now, though. It's interesting. The, you know, the top-down presidential divide has made it harder for people in real communities to gather. You know, the town hall meetings in my town are less populated than they used to be because people don't want to run into the other side. It's tricky. I mean, but we have to kind of renegotiate our community connections. And I suppose nothing will do that faster than a big storm or a economic crisis. If there's no food in the grocery store, the town will either have to come together or everyone's going to hole up with their shotguns and protect their cupboards.
And here again, you know, human nature is such that when crises like that hit, people actually tend to come forward with pro-social behaviors. If the electricity grid goes down, people come out of their houses, start talking to one another, and doesn't matter, you know, whether they're red or blue or brown or green or whatever, you know, people tend to, it's not universal, of course, but the overwhelming tendency is for people to share what they have, try to figure out how to solve their problems, help each other out. Yeah, you're right. I mean, that's what we need to count on. It's the longer term response to economic decline that gets tricky, because if people feel the economy declining and they don't have a good way of dealing with that to shield themselves from the consequences or to negotiate their way with others through it, the result tends to be scapegoating. You know, people look for somebody to blame. And I think that's where we are right now as a country. You know, our economic vision for where we should be right now is not being met by reality. You know, the economic inequality in the country is growing. And a lot of folks, particularly in the working class, are seeing that they're being left behind, and they're looking for somebody to blame. So it's easy for you know, a demagogue to come along and play on that, but it only hurts us in the long run.
Right. I mean, it's funny when you were talking about how pro-social behaviors tend to emerge, you know, in a blackout or a flood. I mean, they seem to emerge, but they seem to last for like 3 days. And then I remember when there was a Hurricane Sandy came and knocked out all the power in my area, and people were good for 2 or 3 days, and then they're on the gas lines with their cans for the generators, and then the fights start to break out in the parking lot of the Home Depot. And I was sort of amazed. This is Westchester, you know, and guys are rolling up their sleeves and fighting out in a parking lot. I'm thinking, oh my gosh, if it takes, you know, 3 days of no heat to break down social decorum in a wealthy New York neighborhood, this doesn't right. bode well for our disaster preparedness.
That's why we're talking about community resilience, building up the ability of communities to maintain that social cohesion in a changing landscape. Because those changes are on the way. It's not just one hurricane here or there. Fortunately, you know, resilience science is something that's been, you know, researched and developed to quite a great degree over the last decade or so. There's a lot that many researchers have done to bring this into practical cases, and that's what we're trying to do at Post Carbon Institute with programs like our Think Resilience series, and we have a new community resilience reader that's just being published now. So, you know, there's a whole scope of ideas that we can share that I think could help a tremendous amount to get us through this time.
So how would you imagine a tool like the Community Resilience Reader, which has, you know, real programs and steps in it for how to do this? Who do you imagine, you know, buys or downloads that? And then how do they bring that to their community? Does it have to be the mayor or the principal of the school? Or can just some listener now who lives in a town and wants to start initiating these processes, can they just decide to do it?
Yeah. It's all of the above. I mean, certainly, if you've got the mayor and other city officials on board, that's very helpful. But it often doesn't start at that level. Often it starts at the level of ordinary citizens who see the importance, and they bring it to the attention of others within the community and maybe have classes at the local library. And we have, you know, the Think Resilience video series is perfect for that. And then it can go on to doing a community resilience assessment. And that's something that really should be done in cooperation with local officials. Otherwise, you know, those local officials aren't going to pay any attention when it's done. But I think it's pretty easy to make the argument these days that every community needs to be prepared. So how do you get prepared? Well, you start by assessing where you are now. What are the likely threats? What are local assets? Who are the people within the community who are tasked with responding to these foreseeable crises? And how can they be supported by the rest of the community? Whether it's here in California with earthquakes or along the Gulf Coast with hurricanes or, you know, every place has foreseeable crises. And in virtually every instance, you know, you can talk to people in authority and they'll tell you, well, we're not nearly as prepared as we should be. So this is really a matter of taking the position of the adult in the room and working with others who are concerned about more than just their own immediate welfare, looking to the future and looking to the welfare of society as a whole. And when people get together on that basis, it really provides an avenue, an opportunity for some really mature thinking.
I mean, in a reasonable best case scenario, with topsoil depletion being what it is, mm-hmm. with the bees going extinct, with peak oil either having happened or about to, with geopolitical instability, do you see community resilience as a way to actually usher kind of civilization as we know it through this gauntlet, or as more of a way for people, for human beings, to try to pick up the pieces after this kind of zombie apocalypse event necessarily happens?
Well, I think it's both. I think it's really important that we preserve as much as we can of what we've achieved over the past centuries. You know, we have discovered really, really valuable things about how the human body works and about the universe and physics and chemistry and ecology and on and on, and at great societal cost. You know, we've invested a tremendous amount in learning these things. And you look back at ancient Egypt, for example, and what was probably lost when that civilization collapsed, or Rome or Greece, what we have, you know, today after the burning of the Library of Alexandria and all the rest, is just, you know, a remnant of what those civilizations achieved. And we're in a kind of similar situation now, where you look at how our information is stored, you look at the vulnerability of our technological systems, like the electricity grid, and it's very, very easy to spin out a scenario where just about all of that could be lost, and people, you know, just a few decades from now would have no access to the amazing cultural achievements that we all take for granted. It doesn't have to be that way. We could, at this point, invest a relative trivial amount of our societal abundance in making these achievements more resilient. And if we don't, you know, then I think future generations are not going to have very kind words for us.
Yep, and it could take them some centuries or longer to pick up the pieces and
right.
Get to a new wonderful, interesting place. Well, thank you so much for joining us on Team Human. I mean, your work is super important, and I'm glad that it's reaching more and more people, and particularly the recent manifesto.
Yeah.
There's no app for that. Technology and morality in the age of climate change, overpopulation, and biodiversity loss, which has a nice video that goes along with it, is a good, easy, accessible way for people to begin to pursue this line of thought, and hopefully this line of action.
Yep.
So thank you for joining, for being on Team Human.
Well, it's been great talking with you, Doug. I've really enjoyed our conversation.
Thanks for listening to Team Human. If listening just isn't enough for you, there's more. Become a subscriber to Team Human, gain access to our Slack channel, get some free signed books, and join us in making this whole thing happen. Go to teamhuman.fm and click on support, or go to patreon.com/teamhuman. Team Human is a team effort, and our team is managed by producer and engineer Stephen Bartolome. We'll be back in the Media Squat next week with new strategies for keeping this strange and wonderful project called humanity alive and well. Team Human, our last best hope for peace.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.